Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community. When did your guys' turkey season start?
Mississippi's open.
Yep.
Started Saturday.
Oh, really? Our youth weekend is this coming weekend, and then our general starts the weekend after. So we're behind you guys.
Well, that answered one question. You're turkey hunters.
Oh, yeah. I've become a turkey hunter. When Jeff hired me 8 years ago, I didn't grow up turkey hunting, and he goes, do you know how to turkey hunt? And I said, not really. And he goes, well, figure it out, because you're going to be guiding people. And I was like, all right. So it's been fun for me, because it's relearning hunting again, and I get to make all the dumb mistakes I made, you know, when I was 10 years old and waterfowl hunting, but now I'm older. So I'm like a born-again turkey hunter. I started later in life, but every other hunting was, you know, growing up knee high to a grasshopper kind of thing. So it's a passion of mine now for sure.
Yeah. That's awesome. And we're lucky out here. We have so much public ground, you know, especially on the river system on the Sac River, that's just open 7 days a week and a lot of birds. So, you know, public land hunter, it's pretty fortunate.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Amazing. I actually turkey hunted California last year for the first time ever.
Oh, and nice.
Just the scenery and
whereabouts were you?
I was on Sonoma Mountain.
Okay.
So it was pretty neat for me to see gobblers strutting in, you know, vineyards.
That's where Carson lives.
I was gonna say, I live over there. I live in Napa, so I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's just we don't have anything like that remotely like that around here. So that's the cool thing about traveling and hunting other areas.
Yeah, I think what people like about us, you know, we don't have tags. We have our upland validation. You can kill your 3 birds in the spring, and there's no reporting, which is kind of strange in the sense, you know, California and how strict we are. There's no reporting. You kill your 3 birds, and you're done. As opposed to some other states, you can get one or have tags, and it's nice.
Yeah,
it was real interesting for me to learn. I had no idea that vineyard culture in Napa, how tied it was. I mean, I felt like I was talking to farmers from Arkansas. I mean, tourists that are out there doing their thing, but then the vineyards are farms, and they were just thrilled to see somebody like me out there turkey hunting, knocking on doors, trying to get permission.
You didn't drink wine?
Oh yeah, we did that.
No, it's exactly like you said, it's farms. My wife works in the wine industry, and I've been on multiple vineyards that I'm out there to help try to take care of pigs because of the damage they're doing in the vineyards.
Yeah.
A lot of people have no clue.
They don't have any idea, but it's same a lot of the same struggles we have here that y'all have out there. So I learned a lot. It was cool.
That's nice.
Well, good. Well, all I wanted
on here.
No, that's good. Perfect.
Perfect. Well, I wanted to welcome everybody back to another episode of Save It for the Blind podcast with Carson and Jeff. And today's guests are awesome. We'll find out if they're awesome. We have Jeff Farmer, Field Norris, and John Strange from Shen Gear all the way. Where are you guys at right now? Arkansas or Mississippi?
Neither.
Which one?
Memphis,
Tennessee. Tennessee. Did you guys avoid the tornadoes that rolled through?
I think Tennessee did.
Good. That was
a lot of farms crazy in Arkansas. My farm had a tornado go through it. A lot of the stuff in kind of the neighborhood of where my farm is had tornadoes go through it. I know some stuff up by y'all's too. Luckily nobody was hurt where we are, and there was no massive damage, but that house on the corner when you're coming into White Oaks, gone.
Is it really?
Totally gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's some serious damage in Arkansas, but I think Tennessee missed it.
Yeah, California, you know, we have our wildfires and stuff, but even we had a weird storm. There was tornado warnings yesterday here, which we never get.
And really?
Yeah, every like year there'll be a funnel cloud that'll like come down and maybe touch, but we just don't see them. So when you do see a tornado warning, it's like, what's going on? just not our thing. We have our wildfires and floods.
Yep.
We dodged the worst of it, I think, from what everybody I know that I can tell. So,
so can you guys talk about the founding of the company? And we always laugh out here is, how do you pronounce the name properly? And what's the... And everyone's got their own, you know, version of it. So we're just laughing out here. So how, what's the proper pronunciation and what's the meaning of the name?
Shin comes, it's a French word and it's shin, like the part of your leg.
Yeah. Your name.
Right. Yeah. And it's a French word that means oak. And the southeastern duck hunter, we all dream at night wishing we were standing next to an oak tree in the flats and the hardwood bottoms of Arkansas, standing next to oak trees. And kind of so much of the culture and the heritage was originally, I mean, those areas were originally settled by French settlers. And so a lot of the rivers have French names, whether it's the Cache, the Langi, these are all big famous duck hunting flyways in Arkansas. Yep. It's all French terminology. And so we liked the way it sounded and liked the way it connected us with where we love to be, which is standing next to an oak tree.
Right on. Now, what's your guys' background prior to getting and starting this business?
We were duck hunters.
Yeah. Oh, of course, right?
You got to get John's face in there for a minute. We're duck hunters. So John and I have a background in finance. We both come from a regional financial services firm, and Jeff, I'll let you tell
yeah, you. I've been in real estate development in one way or another, my whole life, basically. I developed shopping centers and apartment complexes, and also have developed a bunch of recreational hunting properties,
okay,
kind of with the same development mindset and formula. But the one and the other partner, Jeff Jones, he was with another outdoor company. He worked with Drake for 15 or 20 years. And so even though I would say a part of my career has been recreational property development, I would also say that about John and Field, even though they don't as readily admit it as I do. And so what you found between all four partners was we had a connection. We were beyond a weekend warrior waterfowler. We all built our lives around waterfowl and our livelihoods around waterfowl in one way or the other, whether it was Jeff Jones working in directly in the industry, building products for multiple companies over the last 20 years, or John and Field, who developed, you know, 5 or 10 great farms, great hunting properties. And I've done the same thing. In one way or the other, we've all made a life out of duck hunting. And so it doesn't feel like, none of us hunt 14 days a year, you know, every weekend. We're trying to figure out how to hunt 50 days a year. So
did you all know each other beforehand?
We did. Actually, we were Jeff and John and I were working on a project together. I mean, we were developing a duck farm together, you know, about the time that we had that conversation in the woods about our gear.
Yeah. So where did this conversation start for the start of Shin?
I would say it's kind of a rhetorical conversation. If y'all been around duck hunters as long as we have, and you're always complaining about something, the weather, the gear, the, you know, the migration, whatever it is.
And wet feet.
Yeah. The wet feet. That's where it came from with us, is we're like, man, it's a little different now. Like, we've got people in outer space launching satellites. We're about to send people to the moon. Like, they're all of this advanced technology, and we're still bitching about wet feet and a pair of waders not making it through one duck season. And now the products have gotten better. So maybe we get two seasons out of it, but then when it's time to send them in for repair, you know, that process is clunky and it takes 9 months. And it's just like, there's got to be a way to fix that. You know, I mean, there's just too many revolutionary processes now that we shouldn't have this same question. And we joke about it and we, you know, put our stuff up and the next season we're right back out there in the woods saying the same thing. So that's really how it started.
But yeah, all of us care passionately about duck hunting. And when we're out there, we care about making making the most out of every minute we have in those woods. And if you're there and your kid, your 16-year-old has wet feet, your hunt's over, you know?
Absolutely.
Or I'm frustrated. Like, we all hold ourselves to a very high level. And like, how can we expect great things about every part of our life? But then while we're doing the one thing we love the most, we're okay with being wet all the time or cold all the time, or I got to buy 3 pairs of waders. I mean, I was 4 or 5 pairs of waders to get me and my son through hunting season. It was crazy. And, you know, Field and John kind of talked about starting a company, and they came to me and I was like, hell yes. I mean, this is no brainer. There has to be a way to do this better, to Field's point. And then Jeff Jones was the kind of the magician who knew how to do it. It took some innovation and some hard-headedness, and you know, we're going to look at things differently, and we're not going to accept no for an answer on how to solve these problems. And Jeff did that and did a great job. And so it really started from a frustration of this just isn't good enough.
But once you have that conversation and then you think, well, wait a minute, what if we really try to do something about it? All of a sudden your mind shifts and you start to dream and envision like, well, if we had a blank piece of paper and we could create, you know, the perfect brand with the perfect people behind it, what would that look like? You know, how would we take care of people? How would we give back to our communities? How would we support the sport and the resource that we all love and grow it? Because we all know license sales are declining, and like, there's got to be a future to this. Well, then you start to dream, and you dream big, and you start scratching things out on paper, and you map it out in your minds. You start telling that story to your buddies, and it resonates. And when you see the light bulb go off, it snowballs, you know, and that's how I think it happened so fast, really, is that we got super excited and engaged and energetic and just, I don't know, it was like starting all over again for John and I. I've only been in business 20 years. John's probably been in business 60 or 70 years, but I felt like a kid again, getting out of college, starting all over.
I was talking about that blank piece of paper, and that really is where it started. Jeff Jones being the magician. We said, what if you had a blank piece of paper and you could build the perfect wader? We want to build a wader that does not leak. And he said, you can't do it. They're built out by humans. Something's going to go wrong. You can't do it. And we said, well, how close can you get? And he said, well, what I would do is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we said, let's do that. And I'll never forget. He goes, no one is going to buy this wader. It's going to cost way too much to build this. And we did. I remember farmer saying, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
And so we built as many as we could the first year, and we sold out. It was like, holy moly, don't breathe. People really, you know, people bought into this idea about a really, really high quality product.
Yeah.
And it happened the second and third and the fourth year. And it's like, people really do pay up for really high quality gear.
Yeah. That was one of the things that I found when you guys launched, and it was like, who's this company in the waterfowl industry that nobody's ever heard of in their first products? A waiter that's $1,000, and it's like, where's the backing behind it? And you guys were basically backing yourself. Were you guys worried at all about the public perception of like, hey, we're new here and here's one of the most expensive waiters on the market and hopefully you like it?
No,
I don't really think I
was about to say we didn't care.
We didn't really care. This plan, we didn't.
It was that lack of caring came from we all had other jobs.
Yeah.
We started this as a passion project and it turned into something very big, very quick. But when building the product, as John said, we never once, not one time, did we talk about cost ever. It was make it waterproof. I don't care what it costs.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's truly waterproof, like it can't be $5,000. It can't cost that much, you know, like, if it's truly substantially better than what's on the market, and if we can connect with our customers through excellent customer service, mm-hmm. they will pay. And quite frankly, the way the math worked out and us being, you know, primarily direct to consumer, we were able to spend more on the product and the margins were still okay because we're not going through a middleman.
Right.
And so we put a lot more money into building our product because, you know, we're not sharing that profit with Bass Pro or Academy Sports or whoever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how long was it before the inception to putting your product out there to the market?
2 years.
We tested them for 2 years, and I mean, and it changed a lot. Like, if you go back and look some of the original pictures,
first waders were kind of rough.
They were great. They felt great, but they were ugly, and they.
We got a pair in, and the boots were backwards. Like, oh, leg had to go. It was really cool. I think we still have that waiter.
That's great.
Yeah, it was about 2 years of testing and before we, I mean, of getting it right before we decided to launch it. We launched in July of 21.
Yep.
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 And then you have now the 2S waders coming out. So what's the innovations or the changes with those as compared to the originals?
Man, I wish Jones could answer that.
The 2S waiter came out last year. It came out last February. So this is year two of the 2S waiter. And it simply eliminated a lot of the seams. Instead of 7 pieces of fabric being put together, and so you have that many different seams, we ended up with 2, hence the 2S. Yeah, so there's really sense. 2 seams in the whole waiter. And by doing that, you eliminate the seams, create failure points.
Yeah.
And so you eliminate your possible failure points or reduce them dramatically. So we cut the possible places that could cause problems down by like 75%, which frankly, if you're our customer and you got, you know, waders year 1, 2, or 3, we give you a lifetime warranty on it. If one of those seams fails or whatever, we're going to fix it anyway. So the actual, what the customer sees is less of a change, but what we're seeing is we're going to have to repair or fix many less waders.
And when people are sending their waders back, if they do have a tear or whatever, you guys are doing that in-house in Tennessee somewhere where you're repairing the...
About 14 yards behind me.
Nice.
Yep. It's all done in-house in our shop here in Memphis. And it's something we really care about. We kind of own that process. We control that process. We're very dedicated to turning those quickly, particularly during hunting season. You bring them in. Most hunters are hunting Friday through Sunday at the most. You know, you bring me your waders on Sunday or Monday, we'll have them back to you by that Friday or Saturday. So you're not missing a week, which is very different. I mean, I've owned every kind of waiter there was in the world growing up hunting, and some companies had great waiters and great warranties, and they honored them. They were not bad companies, but you'd send your waiter off to a third party, and you'd get them back 3 to 9 months later. Well, that doesn't help me on December 12th when I'm planning on hunting 45 more days, you know?
Yeah.
So really put a lot of effort into owning that process, and I know you've got something to say on
that. Yeah, I mean, just from a kind of back to flipping that blank piece of paper over, if you try to solve every problem you can from end to end, you know, not just in the product design and the stuff that Jeff Jones can go real deep with Gear Junkies on, but for some of us, it was equally as important to solve like the process, the cumbersome pain in the rear of sending your waiter in and hoping you get a warranty claim and then having to have a backup, you know, you gotta have a backup pair to make it through the season. My first business, I started a guide service when I was 14 years old with my cousin, Will, who was 16. And I mean, I know from those days, like if I had to have a pair of waiters that functioned every day in order to make money, or I had to go with wet feet. So we start thinking about like, how quickly can we turn them? And not only that, but if we cannot meet an outfitter that walks in the door, because he's not here locally, what can we do with overnight? You know, we got FedEx headquarters, world headquarters is right here about a mile down the street from us. Do we have a competitive advantage to be able to have priority points with FedEx, to get that waiter shipped back to a guide in California, so maybe he only misses one day after we make a repair? Then we said, well, let's take it a step further. You know, could we start a program where there, you know, people can jump in and line? Can we do a loaner share? Can we overnight somebody a pair of waders to make sure that they don't miss a day? I mean, we start thinking through that whole process. And Jeff mentioned the youth, you know, the kids, like we've all got kids and we've all been through that. I'm sure everybody on this call has seen a kid's hunt kind of cut short because he got wet or she got wet. That came out of the same process. We're like, well, let's start a youth program where, you know, our children have the ability to have an equally as good product as dad, but we want mom or dad to be able to afford that product. So all those things, the theme here is just whether it's product related or service related or innovation, you know, it all goes back to us being authentic users and everybody in this place. I mean, all 55 of us being just hardcore authentic waterfowlers. We know what the problems are and we're trying to solve them. And there's still a lot to solve out there.
And can you touch on a little bit more on that, the youth wader program? Is did I read it right? Like you buy a pair of waders and then just keep, as the kid grows out of them, send them back and they just kind of keep going through their sizes. How does that work?
Yeah, that's right. And so the problem with youth waders where you could go buy a cheapo pair of waders for $75 from, you know, whoever, and but they leaked or they weren't any good. But nobody wants to spend $1,000 on a pair of waders and you got to replace them every year.
Right.
Most kids, when they hunt, they're really 95% or more. Yeah, I mean, I'm as avid as a duck hunter as there is on this planet. My kids hunt 5 or 6 days a year, my young ones, you know? So what we could give them a wader. We took the zipper out of it because they're little. They don't need the zipper like us old men. So we made the product a little more affordable. So the youth waders are a little less expensive than the normal waders. That helps mom and dad. But number two is when they go from third grade to fourth grade or fourth grade to fifth grade, they go through a growing spurt and their foot goes up two sizes. The dad doesn't have to go spend another $800 or $1,100 or $900 buying a new pair of waders. You just trade them in. And we're getting in a pair of waders that's only been worn 5 or 6 times. You know,
yeah.
That 12-year-old is not putting the abuse on waders like the guys like us who are hunting almost every day or 30 days a year. It's very different if you think about how a child actually uses those waders. They just don't get the wear and tear. And even if they did, that's okay. We can fix them in-house. So it allows dad to spend $800, $900 one time and keep his kid in those waders until presumably they're full grown or close to full grown.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I have a young kid that is starting to come with me and hunt, and that's exactly right. Right. Year after year, if it's the jacket or the waders, nothing fits. So you're talking to buddies and, hey, what sizes do you have to do some, you know, bartering and trading just so you don't have to go out and buy brand new stuff every year. And it's new stuff, right? It's not been worn or worn out. So.
And you don't want to put your kid in crappy gear either. Like if there's someone who needs to be uncomfortable out there, it's the kid.
Yeah.
Like he needs to be warm. Like I want him to want to come back. I want him to be excited about it. And if he's sitting there miserable, trying not to complain to upset dad because his feet are cold, he doesn't want to come back the next time. So how do we make it better for these kids to want to come back and to make it affordable where the dads and the moms can bring them?
I also there's a factor too of, you know, you want to wear everything your dad or your grandfather or your mom wears when you're out there. And I vividly remember at 9 years old in the woods, I had my mom and dad and my grandfather all standing there. And I just remember looking at them wanting to be just like them, you know, and I wanted to wear exactly what they were wearing. I wanted the same Coca-Cola wood duck call that my grandfather had. Like, that's just how kids are, right? They're super impressionable. So it's really neat to see these kids open their first pair of shin waders, just like mom or dad has. And they get super excited about it. And I don't know, it's just, I think there's that kind of nostalgic component to this whole program too.
Yeah. Now, so you guys launch your waders, super successful. And now, you know, here 2025, you guys have everything from scout boots, leather stuff, backpacks, jackets, kind of you name it. Was that kind of always the goal, or was it just, hey, let's make the best pair of waders that we can, and oh, by the way, let's go fix all this other
we did stuff. It right, let's do some more stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was much more It was much more the second thing you said, like, wow, okay, those sold. I'd like a better jacket too. It turned into, what is it that we like? You know, like, wait a minute, we can make this better. We made this product better. Like the Scout boot, that's a perfect example. There's 100 companies that make a Scout boot. We make a great one. We kind of applied the same principle as the waiter. Like, don't worry about cost. Just make a better product. And if you make a better product, you're going to win in the long run.
Yeah, so I wear mine literally every day. So
awesome. So, like, we could go deep on that. But a couple things, I'll piggyback on what Jeff said. We really never intended to try to put SKUs out. I mean, we're a direct consumer model. We want to build things that we're really proud of, that that we can use and abuse and have raving fans. So when the other stuff, there's some things that came along that we needed for like our content gathering. And, you know, we needed the same camo pattern that we were using in our waders and other gear. And there just weren't a lot of good options for that. So some of that stuff, you know, we made out of necessity. Other things we improved upon and found a way to do something better. But all of it, you know, like the one thing we're never going to do is make something just to make it or just to drive sales. Like we would rather suffocate sales and go backwards for a couple years and do something really, really well. So we're going really narrow and really deep with all of our stuff. And to Jeff's point, you'll see things like our you'll see threads of our core kind of values and belief systems throughout the product line. You'll see wax cotton heritage things and canvas things, because that's who the four, like, it all started with us saying, we don't want to abandon, you know, grandpa's cool blind bag. Like there is a place for that. And is there a place for a technical bag? Yes. But are there a million technical bags out there? Yes. And their company's doing a great job. We don't need to focus on all of those innovative things right now. Let's focus on things that we can really nail, and let's bring in some heritage pieces that make it fun, you know, that remind us of those.
Yeah, Jeff is a wax canvas freak, and he was looking at your guys' website before. He's like, they got a wax canvas backpack.
Yeah,
and
that
wax
was new. Canvas. I haven't seen that one.
It's all he wants to wear is wax canvas.
I mean, that backpack's a great idea, a great example. Jones wants to duck hunt in the woods with a backpack. Yeah. And he wants to use that wax canvas backpack. And it also makes a great travel bag. I just got back from spring break and walking through the airport. I mean, I was my kids were screaming up and down, kind of like seven of those bags going through, you know, on the travel, on the carry-on. So,
but it's probably not as big of a seller as if we had built the best technical duck hunting backpack.
We don't sell. Sell any of them, you know,
That's not what I wanted to use in the woods. I have an old Filson blind bag that my dad gave me when I graduated high school. And, you know, the zipper's torn. It's 30 years old. Filson made an incredible product. I'm not knocking the product. I love it.
Yeah.
But look, why don't we make the stuff we like the stuff we like to use? And I believed, and we all kind of believed, one, I want to build it better than whatever's out there so that I can use a better product. And two, we think there's a lot of hunters like us. If we like the product, there's probably some other people that do too. And we don't bat 1,000 on that. Like, we built this badass wax canvas jacket. I loved it. I was a big fan of it. And, you know, people, we sell a fraction of those compared to our technical jackets. But that's okay. I still wear my wax canvas jacket in the woods, and it's not near as good. It's not near as warm. It's heavier.
Yeah.
I like it. It reminds me of hunting with my granddad when that's what he was wearing when I was 12 years old, you know?
Yep. No, absolutely. But kind of to your point, you know, waterfowl hunters are a different breed, and they're not afraid of paying for quality, right? I mean, if you like something, you're going to buy it and you're going to use it and you're going to abuse it. And if it's good, it's going to last a while. I mean, I've got some articles of jackets and stuff beat the heck out of, but you know, you paid a good price for that product, and your guys' kind of line is like that, where you're paying for quality and it's going to last a while. So hunters aren't really scared of that, in my opinion.
No, and the great innovation that you guys brought along, you know, a warranty where you turn it around. If I can pay even, you know, $2,000, I get a pair of waders where I know if I break them, I can keep getting new ones. Okay, that's, at this point, five seasons of waders that would cost me $400. So fork it over once and be done with it and just have quality gear.
Exciting news. Our hunt program is now accepting applications for spring turkey and pig hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply today. We're also offering free mentor turkey hunts at the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge, an incredible opportunity for new hunters to gain hands-on experience in the field. Our Camp Sprig registrations are now open. If you have a young hunter looking to obtain their hunter education certificate, we offer 5 2.5-day camps June through August. These are designed to get hands-on learning in the field. While you're there, don't miss out on our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Some of our upcoming events are our Reading Banquet, April 12th, our Gold Rush Banquet in Auburn, April 19th, and our Napa Sonoma Banquet on April 18th. CalWaterfowl.org.
This makes sense.
And think about how effective it is for like people who to feel. Phil talked about this earlier. You know, we have this big shop in Stuttgart, which is the capital of duck hunting in Arkansas. I mean, it's a tiny little town, but it is where everybody converges. And there's hundreds of guides and outfitters down there, thousands probably. And they can't go a week without a waiter. So we said, you know what? We want to service you guys. You come in. We'll give you a loaner. Like, we'll just give you a brand new pair out of the box. Just bring them back in 5 days when we get your waiters fixed.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty cool program for those guys. And so we hope we win fans. And we're, you know, our products, like Field said, they're made by humans. We make mistakes. And we hope that we try so hard to treat people right and do the right thing and create great products that when there is an error, when there is a product failure, they forgive us because we're doing everything we can to cure it, make it right, and treat them like we'd want to be treated.
That's exactly, that's what I think is a key theme is like these things aren't made out of pixie dust, angel hair. I mean, it's human beings still doing the cut and sew process. So we're going to have problems and we're going to have plenty of opportunity, I think, and hope to shine in our service arena. So the product game, as cool as it is to talk about, and as much as Jones can go deep with any gear junkie that wants to talk product, I feel like it's just an arms race, you know, and there's always going to another brand's going to come out and make something better. And then we're going to try to make it better. So we're big believers in a rising tide lifts all boats. And we think that's good for the industry, good for the duck hunter and conservation. And, you know, the whole world that we live in. But if we can, one thing that we can do to be a real differentiator that's lasting, I feel like, is this service component and the connection with our community and putting our money where our mouth is. That's where I think you'll see us evolve as a brand and just kind of stay true. The product, the lines, you know, everybody wants to say, what are y'all going to do next? You're going to get into, looks like you're going to get into turkey. Looks like we don't really, I mean, yeah, that's exciting, but we don't really care. What we're concerned about is figuring out how to continue to put handwritten notes in every waiter purchase, even though we're now selling 15 times more than we were 4 years ago when we first, I mean, we had our wives and kids writing, you know, hundreds of notes. We gotta figure out how to do thousands of notes and get them shipped out on time. And those are the things that we sit around at a board level and spend hours talking about, is how do we stay that connected to the customer so that potentially that first person's experience with a luxury brand, when they open that box, is a really big wow factor, you know, and that then they want to continue to affiliate with us and come to our film fest and get on, you know, and support all the guides and outfitters and brands and conservation organizations that we support, because we're all kind of connected together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, in a world that people want connection, you know, with all the stuff with social media and all that stuff, but people feel that they're not connected with folks anymore, and to be appreciated as a customer is probably going a long ways, and you guys are reaping those benefits.
Yeah. Customer service is huge. Even, I mean, we see it as a nonprofit, just people coming in and asking questions, and I'm sure you guys get some same stuff. If you respond to somebody within a day for an email nowadays, they're like, wow, thank you. It's like, I'm just doing my job emailing you back. But it's overlooked so much in this day and age that extra little bit of handwritten note, an email that's prompt, goes a long way in the customer base that we have.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. I did this study in the Miami airport the last 2 days. Unfortunately, I had a flight canceled. Two 6 o'clock a.m. flights canceled 2 days in a row. So
you didn't get a handwritten note from United Airlines.
So we were stuck. But the second day, we went back. We showed up at the airport, woke the kids and my wife up at 3 a.m. We get in the Uber. We get to the airport at 4 a.m. So we're first in line, hopefully, to make our 6 a.m. flight. And at 4:30, the ticket desk opened. And I was the first one up there. And he said, "I'm sorry, sir, your 6 a.m. flight's been canceled again. And we can't rebook tomorrow." It's his third day. I looked at my kids. I said, "We're going to stand over here and we're going to watch how angry and upset all of these human beings get in line. And we all know that that ticket agent can't do a darn thing about it. And let's just watch humanity." We watched for 30 minutes and there was one agent that kept her cool and was nice and pleasant, even just getting hammered. And I was like, this is what's wrong with our society today. You know, like, it doesn't take that much to just treat people like humans and be nice and do what you say you're going to do. Hey, I'm going to call you back. I don't know the answer, but I'm going to figure it out and I'll call you back. Yep. If you get a call back from somebody with the right answer, even if it's a day later, you want to go on and leave reviews and you want to send passenger pigeon with, you know, I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I'll get off my soapbox. Well, I mean, that's important to us. I think
it's such a core of how we built this company. And I have two little things to say about this. And we're spending a lot of time on it, but we do as a company and we do as a board and as the founders and the owners. When this first started, you know, Jeff was the product guru and you know, I had a real business mindset to it. And Field said something at a board meeting. I don't think it was directly to me, but he just said, "I want to build a customer service company as much as I want to build waiters." And that was like day one. I was like, holy crap, that is. And I bought into that. I thought about it. I absorbed it. I had not looked at it that way, but I understood immediately the impact that would have. And that is something we have taken to heart from day one. And it's funny. The second point I wanted to make is y'all talked about how big a deal it is to get a call back and talk about how much we focus on continuing to try to create excellent customer service, which is harder and harder as you scale up. That's easy when you sell, you know, a handful of waiters. It's much difficult when you're selling thousands and thousands and thousands of these things. And so we have a board meeting in 3 or 4 days, and I have a bunch of notes from the board meeting. And one of the notes that I have, and we got to update, you know, from our board, one of the notes is we have to continue to invest in customer service. Like, we've bought the software that tells us how long it takes to return every phone call and how long it takes to return every email. And the answer is we're doing it all in under a day, and I'm not satisfied with it. None of us are satisfied with it. Like, we want answers back in a few hours. And that just more than anything shows a commitment and how important that is to all of us to stay so connected at the expense of our profits. Because that has been something that we don't get that customer service anywhere. I dread if I've got to call Apple to figure out how to fix my computer. And they're a customer service company, you know. I dread having to call Amazon to figure out a return, you know. And that is something that we have all four been hyper dedicated to, and we recommit ourselves to it every year and in a very serious and meaningful way.
Jeff Jones is the design guy, and this kind of reinforces what they said about service. Last week, we were circulating an email, and we said, we need two more designers immediately. And Jeff's the design guy. And Jeff said, well, if we hire two more design guys, I want four more service people. And so the commitment to service is paramount.
Good for you guys. That's awesome. We have a question for each of you. What is your favorite product out of your guys' entire line and why?
Can I give you two?
Sure.
All right. This is the way I love to hunt. So here in the South, a typical day would be a 35 degree morning and a 55 degree afternoon. So I would use our really light flyway vest with a wax canvas, probably a brown or mossy oak jacket. I love the mossy oak jacket. Literally, I can wear the brown one duck hunting in a church that afternoon.
Nice.
So that'd be my favorite product.
Right on.
Farmer.
I'm pretty boring, I guess, on this one. My favorite is the waiters. I mean, they're substantially better than everything I had worn in the past. And I'm not knocking other companies. There's some great companies out there that make great waiters, but we built them to serve what we wanted to do. And the fabric's tougher. The seams are better. The boots, we spent a ton of time, research and money building more comfortable boots. We spent a lot of effort figuring out how to get the foot in and out of the boot. Like, how many of us have sat down there and had to pull grandpa's waders off his feet? Like, we don't want to do that. You know, I mean, that's a nightmare. You know, I just remember that struggle all growing up by having to pull my dad's and granddad's waders off of his feet. And so we spent a lot of effort on how to make that fit right, fit smooth, fit snug, in and out easily, comfort of the boot. It's the first product we had. It's a boring answer, but that's the truth. I think we did a good job on that product.
All right, Bill. I may want to change mine.
The waiter's too easy. All right,
it is too easy.
I'm going to give you a self-serving answer. The only product that I had in my mind and on paper for like the last 15 or 20 years, like, I'm not a product guy, but there was one thing that I walked around and asked all kinds of brands to make, and everyone laughed at me. It's called a slew boot. So I got to make it when we started Shin Gear, and it's pretty simple concept, but it's a knee boot that has extra material that can fold down to your ankle in a position if all you need is a knee boot. But if you have a little bit deeper, I used it turkey hunting. Like, we'll always have a gobbler will be roosted on a slew, and it's just a little too deep for your knee boot, but mm-hmm. you don't really need a pair of hip boots, you know? So you can just pop that up real quick and scoot across the slough. And I use them now. I mean, farming in the off season, in the summer, busting beaver dams. Like, we see rice farmers come in and buy the hell out of them. I think we should probably try to push some of those to California. But again, yeah, we don't sell a whole lot of them. I think we may have made like 100 of them the first year.
No, we made a few hundred, but we sold out quick. We were all skeptical. At one point, Field was like, if they don't sell, I'll buy all of them.
Sorry, guys.
They sold out in about 3 weeks. We're like, oh, shit. How long does it take to order more of those?
So I haven't designed a product since. That's my one and done.
It was a victory.
I want to change my. Can I change my?
Yeah.
I got to change it. So if you knew Jeff Jones, when we got started, he was, he wanted to make the most comfortable boot on a waiter ever. And so he said, I'm going to build it out of a tennis shoe. That's what it's going to be. It's going to be a tennis shoe. And about 6 months after selling them, people saying, oh my gosh, I've never worn a boot that is this comfortable. So he had already started designing a knee boot, and the knee boot truly is, the knee boot's a great knee boot. And then he came out with a slew boot, and everybody throughout every rendition was going, oh my gosh, who's building these things? These are the most comfortable boots I've ever worn. This is my change. And both of these guys are going to go, oh, I didn't think about that. It's got to be the Grove boot.
Yeah.
They screwed up. It's the Grove boot. The Grove boot is the best thing he's ever built, and it is my favorite. I could wear it to sleep at night.
So that's the underfoot comfort and kind of our platform footwear. Our platform model is now the slew boot. I mean, the Scout boot.
Scout boot is the rubber ankle.
Scout boot is like,
that's what I wear all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the one you wear all the time. And everybody's got one. And we spent way too long debating whether we needed to build one. Like, how can we build it better? And I'll never forget Jones. He said, all right, I'll show you. What do you say? Every day he's at a hamburger.
Yeah, he said, like, you can buy grade E meat or grade A meat.
Field, every hamburger looks the same, right? A hamburger's a hamburger. So what's the difference in a hamburger? Well, some use ground, you know, sirloin. Some use ground filet. Some use whatever animals in it. I started to get his point. He brought in a deck boot, an ankle boot, and he cut it open. And he opened it up. He said, there's the inside of your hamburger. Here's the inside of mine. And it's just, once you see that, you're like, oh my gosh, there is a lot. If you're willing to invest and spend money, there's a whole lot you can do to make a better, more comfortable, longer lasting boot, even though it may look the same on the outside. So the Grove boot John's talking about, back to us just being authentic users, we love that platform. We love that that boot and the functionality, but we wanted something that was a little nicer.
that we could wear to church or to work or to school. And it didn't sweat as much.
Work. Anyway, that's enough about our product design lineage.
That's awesome. I obviously, you know, your guys' success has been on a strict uphill. What challenges did you guys face? Was there any challenges with getting material or getting the final product right? What was your biggest challenge in the last 5 years of your company that you guys have had to overcome?
That's a great question. I have what I think. Well, this is silly. You're going to say that's not even a challenge. I'd say it's time. And this sounds kind of weird. Obviously, no one has enough time in the day. But you're right. We didn't know that this was going to be this successful this quickly. At least I would say none of us knew it was going to be this successful this quickly. And trying just to scale up, like we need two designers 6 months ago. We didn't know we needed two designers 6 months ago till 3 weeks ago. And it was like, oh my gosh, we need more people. Just not enough time in the day. Dennis Zuck is the CEO of this business. Dennis, today I saw him earlier. We're eating hamburgers. That's something's culture, something we do. We had smash burgers for everybody today. And Dennis said, oh my gosh, at this board meeting, I don't know if we're going to have enough time to go over all the stuff that's on my calendar, things that we've got to get accomplished. So that'd be my answer would be if we could make a 30-hour work day instead of a 24-hour work day, I'd be in favor of it.
That's good. I mean, we've had all kinds of, you know, issues. I mean, we started during COVID. We've had material issues, shipping, you know, costs, containers, all the normal things y'all probably heard, you know, from other business owners. But I think the biggest thing for us is what John said is scalability and trying to figure it all out as we go, because we've never launched a brand like this. I mean, we are business people, so we've got life experiences. But I think what we've done a really good job of, I mean, we've made plenty of mistakes, but I think the reason we're still cranking is we scaled up quickly. And we made decisions quickly. I mean, we knew we needed to bring in a CEO, a CFO. We knew we needed to do in-house. Like, we made a commitment, and it cost money. I mean, we weren't looking at the P&L to make these decisions. We were asking ourselves, what's the best thing for the brand, and how can we stay true to who we are and how we started? So we made decision to do things in-house. You know, not farm them out. Whether that's our warehousing, our service, our repairs, a lot of our marketing and advertising. I mean, we hired our very first, you know, we made a commitment to do all of our content stuff in-house. So anyway, I think that's probably been, although those have been our biggest challenges, that's probably where we've really nailed it. If we had any secret sauce, it's just people. I mean, we've put the right people in the right places, and we've empowered them to make decisions and make them quickly. And we don't care if they're falling on their face or if they get it wrong. We want them to know we got their back. We got to pick up and move forward though tomorrow, because it's a new day.
Yeah.
And you guys have anything big for this upcoming 2026 season that you guys are wanting to roll out or working on, something that you guys are going to be able to put out to the public?
Why don't you take that field? You're the passionate turkey hunter.
We let it leak down a little bit. This may be the very first podcast. You may have the groundbreaking announcement. We are going to launch a small but mighty turkey line in spring of 26.
Oh,
we're
nice.
Really excited. There's some great innovation in some of the things we're doing, and mm-hmm. just bringing our care and passion and attention to detail on the standard products. There's no great massive innovation you can make for a pair of pants.
Yeah.
You know? Like really good pants that we love to use.
Uh-huh.
There are some products that are bigger. Oh, wows. Yeah. And, we're excited to bring that to market.
Is there a line in the sand that you guys draw about what products you will touch and won't touch? Like, you know, I'm sure you guys have dealt with hundreds of different decoys. It's like, okay, we're never going to get into decoys but whatever it is, boats, shotguns, whatever it is, there a line where it's like, okay, we're not going to touch that? Or is it always looking forward to, you know what, we might be able to do that better?
We would probably all answer this differently, in fairness. And that's part of the struggle.
That's a good way to say it. Yeah.
And that's part of the struggle and the strength of our team. Some of us, you know, have a more focused, dedicated to how we started. Some of us
have a different kind of mindset. I like to think there's no limitations ever on how I think about things, which is distracting. Like, I came up with a whole idea to build. I'm not even going to get into it. I'm like too embarrassed to say it. But that kind of, I also have to be willing, being this big thinker with all these ideas, I have to be willing to accept no to an answer for a lot of them, or have to say, you know, not get my feelings hurt when Field says, Jeff, what are you talking about, man? We're not doing that, you know? But that's also a strength for us too, because you have people from very different backgrounds and very different skill sets and points of view on how to build a company and things that we care about differently. And as opposed to one person who can get tunnel vision and kind of go and kind of make mistakes. So if you have a team that's willing to listen and respect each other's point of views and be outvoted and accepted, then I think it's actually a strength. And so yeah, I would say there is no line in the sand.
It's huge. And I would say
Jeff Jones would say, are you freaking crazy? There's a line in the sand. There's absolutely a line in the sand. Like, when do we make an astronaut outfits? You know, let's figure out how to sell suits to Tesla.
I think that's a good segue. Four years ago, two of us probably say there's a line in the sand, and two of us say the sky's the limit. I think today, if Jones were sitting here, we'd all say there's really no line in the sand anymore, because we've had healthy debate and we're so methodical about how we look at these things when we decide to go into a new product or a new market or hire a bunch of people. I've been proven wrong. I mean, the whole scout boot, that conversation was directed at me. I mean, I didn't want to get away from waders, you know, or knee boots. And when I saw Jones's point, I thought, you know, that's right, let's do it. Now it's like our marquee platform shoe. So but here's where I think what we don't want to do, what you'll never see us do, is go make something just to make it, because we know we can sell it.
So we agree on that.
Yeah.
We don't agree all the time on exactly what to build, but we agree on the philosophy.
The way that if you study any type of, if you study business, the trajectory that we're on right now, we could go just pick a product. We could knock off any product, put our logo on it, and sell it. That's the truth probably, but that doesn't really get, that's not an enduring and long standing brand with a relationship with the customer. That's just trying to sell things. Mm-hmm. You know? So when we approach, like, how should we grow? Can we grow methodically, sustainably? Like, what are the implications of rapid growth? If we do this product, are our teams going to be stressed? Is that going to hurt work-life balance? Like, we ask all those questions, and then we circle all the way back on the whiteboard and say, what problems are we still solving, the problem we set out to solve? And are we still maintaining that core, that high touch with our customer? And if all those answers are yes, and it's a green light, then we move it to the next stage in the funnel, you know? So it's pretty methodical, but I would say at this point, we don't have a line in the sand on anything. And we get some pretty cool ideas from our customers, you know, on things that we could improve upon. And what I love now is, at first it started out, you know, when you look on the Instagram comments and our suggestion box or whatever, it was all product related. And now we're starting to get feedback from, like, man, if you guys, I mean, in different industries, like, if you guys could do this service model, if you could have Morgan, our head of customer service, delivering this same team and this same energy to this, it would be unbelievable. So it's pretty neat to see.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Hey, what was that?
Can you tell we're having fun?
Yeah. No, I love it. So what's the connection with Shen in White Oaks Duckwoods? That's a name that we've heard out here. It sounds like you guys have all been involved with developing some duck clubs and stuff. I mean,
yeah, I'll tell you all about White Oaks.
Leave it for Field.
No, this is Jeff Farmer's baby. We'll let him talk.
But kind of like I mentioned in the beginning of the show, I've always had an eye towards real estate development. And 10 or 12 years ago, the opportunity came up to buy that piece of property. And
My wife thought I was crazy. I kind of had to talk her into going along with it, but I believed I could turn it into something really special. And I believed that even if it didn't work, I wouldn't lose money. That was my pitch to my wife. I promise you, we're not going to lose money. You just have to trust me, dear. And so I built White Oak Start. I bought it in 2015 and put a lot of energy and effort into making it a really cool place. And somehow through the duck hunting world is how I met these guys. So in a way, White Oak made the introduction to me and the rest of the team. And Field and I did a project or two together. And so when Field and John started talking about this, we were already doing other stuff together.
Okay.
So there's no real, the only connection is that I'm involved in both.
Gotcha. Now, like,
I'm also smart enough as a businessman to know that 150,000 followers would may help our product.
Yeah.
And the only reason why I said we got to get Farmer in this deal so I could go hunt at White Oaks.
Of course. I mean, you got a test product there too, right?
There you go.
I mean, like, the clubs that you guys are involved with out here, you know, there's no, how could we put it? There's no new ground being developed essentially for duck clubs, unless someone's buying a big tract of rice ground and converting it back into natural. I mean, the clubs you guys are buying and developing, were these old duck clubs at one time, or is it a tract of land that you guys are developing and making it into what it is today? I mean, if you kind of walk us through that process, it's probably much different than it is out here where we're accustomed to.
Why don't you take that?
I'll start it. There, everybody's going to have a pretty strong opinion on this. So what little I know about, I have a good friend out there. I mentioned earlier, I went turkey hunting, Bronson Lassley. He's a great.
Yeah, we know Bronson really well.
I've known him since a little tiny boy.
Yeah. Do you know him through the calling circuit? Is that how you know him?
Yeah. So that's a great example of our authentic relationships. Like, he's as real as they come. And, you know, we didn't go to California and pay the biggest celebrity a bunch of money to start pushing our stuff on Instagram. We talked to a guy like Bronson and said, hey, it may take a decade, but could we just start hanging out with you and figuring out how to get in with, you know, with people in California? So long story short, what little I've learned of kind of y'all's setup out there is from him and just being out there for a week, driving around, learning about everything from cattle country to, you know, the Sacramento Valley and how things work. A big thing, obviously, is water. So here, I mean, water is abundant. It's not hard to, we don't have water rights. We don't, you know, we've got access to surface water and groundwater. I mean, I'm sure there's permitting involved, but you could pretty much just go drill a well wherever you want and you're going to find water. So that's becoming harder in certain rice counties and parts of Arkansas that have depleted that aquifer. So mm-hmm. I don't want to make it's super easy. It's not, but I mean, you got to know what you're doing. You do have to navigate with the Corps of Engineers, but that's something, that's a challenge y'all have that we just don't have. And then I think what you would find if you're in Arkansas, Mississippi, in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, there are a lot less people around than there are in California. And there's a lot more bottomland hardwood forest and crop ground that never should have been converted to crop ground. It should have been ancient trees and forests. So, you know, the WRP, the old WRP, what's now WRE program, has been a huge success at reforesting a lot of those acres. But there's still a lot of opportunity for private landowners who may not qualify for government programs or may not care, may not want the government on their land to go in and do these projects, maybe with the help of DU or an organization like yours, or maybe just on their own, hiring a private consultant or kind of bending nature the way they think they should. So that, I would say those opportunities to find the good stuff and the really exciting stuff are becoming much harder now with, you know, people like Jeff. Everybody sees what he has and they want it. So it's harder for people like me to find stuff with the social media, the invention of social media. It's like everybody wants to be a duck club developer now, but I'll end on that. We've done both. So we've taken raw ground. Looks like a rice field, but we know from history, talking to landowners and farmers or looking on Google Earth images, there used to be an old slough or oxbow through it, and just those natural spots where ducks go. So we've gone in and bought the rice field farm
and converted it back to what it looked like back, you know, at the turn of the century. And we've also taken old hunting clubs that used to be great, but for whatever reason, they've been mismanaged or overhunted, too much pressure, you know, all the stuff that, that humans do to chase ducks off. Mm-hmm. And we're taking those clubs and kind of, I would call them rehabbed. So a lot of what Jeff Farmer has done professionally, you know, in real estate, commercial real estate or multifamily real estate, you know, you've got ABC properties, you've got ground up build outs, and then you've got rehabs. And so I would say it's very similar the way we look at the world, regardless of what state we're looking at. It's like, what's the highest and best use for this piece of ground? What did God intend it to be? You know, how can we enhance it? And is there an opportunity to do that? And then it gets really exciting to try to figure out. And then the last thing you do is figure out, is it feasible? Can we afford it? You know, but go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's a great answer. I think one of the things that Field touched on that really struck a nerve with me is the formula for success that we have all three of us have used in developing duck properties was in some time or another was finding that farm that's a struggle to farm. It floods 2 out of 3 years. You're fighting getting the water off the thing in the spring, and you're praying to the good Lord that you don't get a river overflow and drowned out your rice in September. You find those farms that are really tough to farm. They're low producing farms. A lot of them are maybe not great bean ground farms, and they're more valuable with 100,000 ducks sitting on them than they are with a 30 bushel bean crop that you get 2 of every 3 years. And so by kind of thinking about it differently, you know, in the 70s and 80s, every square inch of ground that you could take a tree off of and plant a bean, that's what farmers did. And they were making a living. It's actually not a knock on them that they were doing what they needed to do to make a living, but it just completely wiped out duck habitat. And to Field's point, you know, at the turn of the century or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, there was 10 times, 20, 30, 40, 50 times the duck habitat. The natural duck habitat in Arkansas and then of course all the other duck regions in the world. When they cleared that ground for crop ground, that really changed everything. And you fast forward 20, 30 years into the last 5, and you have such advanced techniques for harvesting. The combines are so much better. The fields have been leveled. When I was growing up, every field had a low swag and they got a rain and that 3 acres of beans in the southwest corner of the field didn't get cut and the ducks could feast on that. That's over.
Same out here. Yep.
Fields are turned in, they're disked in, they're burned off. I mean, they're ready to farm in September, you know? And so there's nothing left for ducks there. So the work that Field mentioned of taking some of those farms and putting them back into some sort of habitat is a really big deal. And the WRP, the WRE, and then private landowners who put a lot of resources into creating food. That food is not the same as it was even 10 years ago, just from how efficient the combines are and what a large percentage of the fields are now precision leveled, which just removes the food. The leftover grain from a rice bin is not near what it was 15 years ago. I mean, there's a small fraction of the food available to a duck in a rice field today versus a rice field 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to a farmer friend of mine and I asked him the same question and he looked at me. He's like I was dumb. He's like, but there's barely anything left nowadays. He goes, with all the technology, he goes, I know exactly what I'm cutting, the moisture, everything. He's like, there's not a whole lot left because there's some, but he's like, these things are efficient, you know?
It's a little bit of a hot button issue for me. I mean, people will say, you know, oh my gosh, 20 years ago, we killed them here. You know, what's changed? Well, what's changed is you have a combine that leaves a half a bushel of rice in per acre, not mm-hmm. 4 bushels of rice.
Well, they'll also say 20 years ago, we killed them here. But ever since White Oaks came along, he feeds the ducks and holds the ducks. I'm sure y'all have that in your club.
Yeah. Same thing. And people, you know, also, you know, for us in our flyway, you know, 30 years ago, people were burning rice fields, you know, to get rid of the straw. And then that was, deemed illegal, so they had to flood it up for the decomp. So you went from, you know, 30,000 flooded acres to 80 to 100. You know, that's just, which is great for the ducks. But yep. for the hunter, it spreads the birds out. And then, as you guys know, pressure, birds are smart. They're going to go where humans aren't, and then they're going to feed at night and then go back and sit all day. So unless you have kind of those intermittent storms to kind of get them off their schedule, you know, there's years where, you know, people weren't shooting as well as they once did. And, you know, and the outlaw of lead and all that was around the same time. So yeah, we get a lot of people that complain about, you know, oh, the good old days. But for us now, I mean, we have a 100-day season. You can shoot 30 geese a day. You can shoot seven mallards a day. It's like good old times are kind of now, depending on where you're at. So, yeah.
So do y'all have, on your properties, what's the area? Is it,
Butte Sink? Yeah, Butte Sink. So yeah, we have some in a couple regions, but we have two in the Butte Sink. Another big significant area is the Sassoon Marsh. So we own two there. The California Delta, we own another island down there, and then another significant area is called the Tulare Basin, which historically, there was a lake there that was the largest lake west of the Mississippi, and it didn't exist for about 100 years, and then 2 years ago, it re-flooded an entire area down in that area because of some levee breaches and things like that, but historically, that area was huge for like people in Hollywood, you know, back in the day would fly up, hunt in that area and go. But now there's a refuge there. It's called Kern, and there's a couple older duck clubs that are around it and our property down there as well. But other than those areas, it's kind of a desert, you know. So we kind of own a little bit of everything and some of the more key areas in California.
There's so much there. I mean, there's so much history, and in another, I need 13 lives. In one life, I'd love to just go immerse myself in the California waterfowl history and learn all about those old clubs. It's really, really neat.
Yeah, there's some really cool history in the Sassoon Marsh. The clubs were basically created off the railroad tracks that came from San Francisco. So you'd get the market hunters come from San Francisco, and they call them rail stop clubs, and they're right on the railroad tracks where the guys would get off a train and go hunt and then get back on the train. I've told this story on this podcast, I think before. I was at a club that was on the railroad tracks a couple years ago, and the owner brought out an old picture. He goes, "You know who that is?" And I said, "Yeah, that's Babe Ruth." And he goes, "Yeah, that's at this club." He had been, came in San Francisco to play, went up on the train, got dropped off at the club, hunted, and then came back on the train.
That's so cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Apparently it's like, so you think of this huge marsh with this train running through it. Shouldn't be a train running through a marsh, but apparently back in the day they made sure it went there, right? And it's like the most costliest part of any train track in the U.S. or something like that, but it still runs right through the marsh. Doesn't drop anyone off anymore. But
must have been a duck hunter.
Yeah, back in the day they all got to their clubs that way. So they'd get there on Friday and get picked up on Sunday.
That's really neat. Have you spent much time? Have you ever hunted in this area in Arkansas?
No, that's always been that's the only reason I got into competition calling was to try to Jeff, go back into
Jeff was a competition caller, and he told me, he said, "The only reason I wanted to do it was to go to Arkansas," and he made it all the way to the finals of the California finals and squawked in the finals. Yeah, and got second.
That was fun.
That's a great story.
But no, just on the western side, Pacific Flyway in Canada and all that good stuff. So I haven't made it back there
yet. We'll have to do a hunt swap.
We could definitely do that.
Yeah, you guys want to come out to California?
I'll hold you to it. All right,
good.
Well, cool, guys. We just want to say, you know, thank you for coming on today. But I probably already know your answer since you guys hunt in the woods. But if you could hunt anywhere, where would you hunt, and who would it be with?
Oh my gosh! I know. I hope you talked a long time.
I gotta think about that. Anywhere and with anybody.
Yep.
You have an answer?
It's easy for me. There's no place I'd rather be than the place that I built, place that I poured my heart and soul and passion and. Took massive risk to build the reward from seeing that turn from a blank canvas into this place. Like, I have other places I get invited to go hunt all over the world, and I want to
get up out of my bed and take my coat off of my hook and put my waders on that are outside my door and go with my best friends and my son.
Yep.
That's heaven to me. And I live some sort of, I guess, lucky and blessed life that I'm able to go do that several times a year. So that's easy for me.
Well, I don't know if White Oaks.
So I thought you were going to say the one you went to hunt with is Keith Allen.
I said friends.
I would have lost that. That loosely. All right, John, you're up.
He's been back out here a number of times.
Yeah.
I really, really, really love the peanut fields in Oklahoma. I did that for 15 years.
Okay.
It was completely different than what we do here. It's cacklers and lessers and mallards. It was unbelievable. But if I had to pick one between flooded timber and peanuts, I'd pick flooded timber. I think what I'd like to do is take you guys literally and go to Canada. I've gotten fortunate enough to do that a few times, and it is awesome. It's in September, at least that's when I went, and the camaraderie and the number of birds and the how they work and just hanging out, doing that with buddies. We've never done that. You've done that. I would like you last year, John.
I
can't remember that far backfield.
he's losing.
John, I thought you were going to say you're a closet Oklahoma Sooners fan, but that doesn't sound like it.
No, I think that would be mine. I'd like to get 10 of us, go to Canada and have a freaking blast.
All right. So I'm pretty similar to Farmer. I mean, it would definitely be in this area. That's my ideal. If I could hunt anywhere, I'd want to be right here in the backyard. I'd want to be with a handful of my best friends. And I'd love to hunt with my grandfather one more time. He passed away several years ago, but he would post up in this place and never leave. He would be the full-time quality control
product tester, the above.
So I know he's up there smiling every day, but like, it would be really fun to have my kids and him hunt. But one thing that I don't know that I don't even really know if my partners know this about me, but, as much as I love the flooded green timber, if I could only do one more hunt and I had to pick, I would actually pick a big, wide open oxbow lake in a big blind. Farmer's got a great one called Eagle Lake, so I may choose to go there. But I like big open water where I can just call as loud as I want at them and nobody thinks I'm overcalling, and I can have 2,000 decoys out. It's just fun. So we have some property on the Mississippi River. It's more willow breaks and flats, but when the river rises, I will leave. I'll leave anywhere I am in the country to go hunt Mississippi River migrating greenheads, because they're wads of 50 and 100, and you can call as loud as you want, and they make four passes and they dive in the decoys. So.
That's cool. Yeah, we don't get those big wads out here of mallards. It's
We don't get them much anymore. Yeah. I mean, he does White Oaks. You see him, he gets them every day. But most of us hunting the peasant woods, we get a good push or when the river systems are up and you can find them. But
Jeff, you got to share the love over there with the ducks. Doesn't sound like you're sharing.
And then my travel spot, like last year, 2 years ago, I hunted the Snake River. And it was negative 10 in Washington. And I learned what y'all have over there with the long season and the healthy greenhead limit. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like the scenery and just the whole deal was really, really cool. That was one of the few trips I take where I could see myself doing that every year and leaving what we have here. A lot of them we go on, we travel, they're great. We love meeting people, but we're pretty anxious to get home because we got it pretty good.
Yeah.
But that was one I could post up for a while there.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, yeah, if you wanted to come out to California next year, we get 3 pintail a person. So that's going to be special.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I'm sorry. We wasted all your tape having 3 of us. I'm sure we got long winded, but
no, you guys are good, man. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on, and it's good getting to know you guys.
Absolutely. We appreciate all you do. It's a great organization. I'm looking forward to learning more about it, but, we're big fans of all of your work, and especially the education component, and the things you all do for the next generation, and keep up good work.
We appreciate it. We'll, keep doing good things. We appreciate it, guys. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.